Chapter 21. Health a good deal. Now she was out of the odious prison, and was enabled to take exercise. How gaily did we pace up and down Bridge Street and Chatham Plus, to be sure. And yet, in truth, I was a beggar, and felt sometimes ashamed of being so happy. With regard to the liabilities of the company, my mind was now made quite easy, for the creditors could only come upon our directors, and these it was rather difficult to find. Mr. Bro was across the water, and I must say, to the credit of that gentleman, that while everybody thought he had run away with hundreds of thousands of pounds, he was in a garret at Bowlin, with scarce a shilling in his pocket, and his fortune to make afresh. Mrs. Bro, like a good brave woman, remained faithful to him, and only left Fulham with the gown on her back, and Miss Belinda, though grumbling and sadly out of temper, was no better off. For the other directors, when they came to inquire at Edinburgh for Mr. Mull, W.S., it appeared there was a gentleman of that name, who had practiced in Edinburgh with good reputation until 1800, since when he had retired to the Isle of Skye, and on being applied to, knew no more of the West Didlesex Association than Queen Anne did. General Sir Dionysius O'Halloran had abruptly quitted Dublin, and returned to the Republic of Guatemala. Mr. Shirk went into the Gazette. Mr. McGraw, M.P.P. and King's Counsel, had not a single guinea in the world, but what he received for attending our board. And the only man seizable was Mr. Manstraw, a wealthy navy contractor, as we understood, at Chatham. He turned out to be a small dealer in marine stores, and his whole stock in trade was not worth 10 l. Mr. Abednego was the other director, and we have already seen what became of him. Why, as there is no danger from the West Didlesex, suggested Mr. Hoskins, Sr., should you not now endeavor to make an arrangement with your creditors? And who can make a better bargain with them than pretty Mrs. Titmarsh here, whose sweet eyes would soften the hardest-hearted tailor or milliner that ever lived? Accordingly, my dear girl, one bright day in February, shook me by the hand, and bidding me be of good cheer, set forth with Gus in a coach, to pay a visit to those persons. Little did I think a year before, that the daughter of the gallant smith should ever be compelled to be a suppliant to tailors and haberdashers. But she, heaven bless her, felt none of the shame which oppressed me, or said she felt none and went away, nothing doubting, on her errand. In the evening she came back, and my heart thumped to know the news. I saw it was bad by her face. For some time she did not speak, but looked as pale as death, and wept as she kissed me. You speak, Mr. Augustus, at last said she, sobbing, and so Gus told me the circumstances of that dismal day. What do you think, Sam? Says he, that infernal aunt of yours, at whose command you had the things, has written to the tradesmen to say, that you are a swindler and impostor, that you give out, that she ordered the goods, that she is ready to drop down dead, and to take her Bible oath she never did any such thing, and that they must look to you alone for payment. Not one of them would hear of letting you out, and as for Mantellini, the scoundrel was so insolent, that I gave him a box on the ear, and would have half killed him, only poor Mary Mrs. Titmarsh I mean screamed and fainted. And I brought her away, and here she is, as ill as can be. That night, the indefatigable Gus was obliged to run post-haste for Dr. Salts, and next morning a little boy was born. I did not know whether to be sad or happy, as they showed me the little weakly thing, but Mary was the happiest woman, she declared, in the world, and forgot all her sorrows in nursing the poor baby. She went bravely through her time, and vowed that it was the loveliest child in the world, and that though Lady Tiptoff, whose confinement we read of as having taken place the same day, might have a silk bed and a fine house in Grosvenor Square, she never could have such a beautiful child as our dear little Gus. For after whom should we have named the boy, if not after our good kind friend? We had a little party at the christening, and I assure you were very merry over our tea. The mother, thank heaven, was very well, and it did one's heart good to see her in that attitude in which I think every woman, be she ever so plain, looks beautiful with her baby at her bosom. The child was sickly, but she did not see it. We were very poor, but what cared she? As he had no leisure to be sorrowful as I was. I had my last guinea now in my pocket, and when that was gone, my heart sickened to think of what was to come, and I prayed for strength and guidance, and in the midst of my perplexities felt yet thankful that the danger of the confinement was over, and that for the worst fortune which was to befall us, my dear wife was at least prepared, and strong in health. I told Mrs. Stokes that she must let us have a cheaper room, a garret, that should cost but a few shillings. And though the good woman bade me remain in the apartments we occupied, yet, now that my wife was well, I felt it would be a crime to deprive my kind landlady of her chief means of livelihood. And at length she promised to get me a garret as I wanted, and to make it as comfortable as might be. And little Jemima declared that she would be glad beyond measure to wait on the mother and the child. The room, then, was made ready, and though I took some pains, not to speak of the arrangement too suddenly to Mary, yet there was no need of disguise or hesitation, for when at last I told her, "Is that all?" said she, and took my hand with one of her blessed smiles, and vowed that she and Jemima would keep the room as pretty and neat as possible. "And I will cook your dinners," added she, "for you know you said I make the best roly-poly puddings in the world." God bless her! I do think some women almost love poverty. But I did not tell Mary how poor I was, nor had she any idea how lawyers, and prisons, and doctor's fees had diminished the sum of money which she brought me when we came to the Fleet. It was not, however, destined that she and her child should inhabit that little garret. We were to leave our lodgings on Monday morning, but on Saturday evening the child was seized with convulsions, and all Sunday the mother watched and prayed for it. But it pleased God to take the innocent infant from us, and on Sunday, at midnight, it lay a corpse in its mother's bosom. Amen. We have other children, happy and well, now round about us, and from the father's heart the memory of this little thing has almost faded. But I do believe that every day of her life the mother thinks of the firstborn that was with her for so short a while. Many and many a time has she taken her daughters to the grave, in St. Bride's, where he lies buried, and she wears still at her neck a little lock of gold hair, which she took from the head of the infant as he lay smiling in his coffin. It has happened to me to forget the child's birthday, but to her never, and often in the midst of common talk comes something that shows she is thinking of the child still, some simple allusion that is to me inexpressibly affecting. I shall not try to describe her grief, for such things are sacred and secret, and a man has no business to place them on paper for all the world to read. Nor should I have mentioned the child's loss at all, but that even that loss was the means of a great worldly blessing to us, as my wife has often with tears and thanks acknowledged. While my wife was weeping over her child, I am ashamed to say I was distracted with other feelings besides those of grief for its loss, and I have often since thought what a master, nay, destroyer of the affections one is, and have learned from experience to be thankful for daily bread. That acknowledgement of weakness which we make in imploring to be relieved from hunger and from temptation is surely wisely put in our daily prayer. Think of it, you who are rich, and take heed how you turn a beggar away. The child lay there in its wicker cradle, with its sweet fixed smile in its face. I think the angels in heaven must have been glad to welcome that pretty innocent smile, and it was only the next day, after my wife had gone to lie down, and I sat keeping watch by it, that I remembered the condition of its parents, and thought, I can't tell with what a pang, that I had not money left to bury the little thing, and wept bitter tears of despair. Now, at last, I thought I must apply to my poor mother, for this was a sacred necessity, and I took paper, and wrote her a letter at the baby's side, and told her of our condition. But, thank heaven, I never sent the letter, for as I went to the desk to get sealing wax and seal that dismal letter, my eyes fell upon the diamond pin that I had quite forgotten, and that was lying in the drawer of the desk. I looked into the bedroom. My poor wife was asleep, as he had been watching for 3 nights and days, and had fallen asleep from sheer fatigue, and I ran out to a pawnbroker's with the diamond, and received 7 guineas for it, and coming back put the money into the landlady's hand, and told her to get what was needful. My wife was still asleep when I came back, and when she woke, we persuaded her to go downstairs to the landlady's parlor, and meanwhile the necessary preparations were made, and the poor child consigned to its coffin. The next day, after all was over, Mrs. Stokes gave me back 3 out of the 7 guineas, and then I could not help sobbing out to her my doubts and wretchedness, telling her that this was the last money I had, and when that was gone I knew not what was to become of the best wife that ever a man was blessed with. My wife was downstairs with the woman. Poor Gus, who was with me, and quite as much affected as any of the party, took me by the arm and led me downstairs, and we quite forgot all about the prison and the rules, and walked a long, long way across Blackfriars Bridge, the kind fellow striving as much as possible to console me. When we came back, it was in the evening. The first person who met me in the house was my kind mother, who fell into my arms with many tears, and who rebuked me tenderly for not having told her of my necessities. She never should have known of them, she said. But as he had not heard from me since I wrote announcing the birth of the child, and she felt uneasy about my silence, and meeting Mr. Smithers in the street, asked from him news concerning me. Whereupon that gentleman, with some little show of alarm, told her that he thought her daughter-in-law was confined in an uncomfortable place, that Mrs. Haggerty had left us, finally, that I was in prison. This news at once dispatched my poor mother on her travels, and as he had only just come from the prison, where she learned my address. I asked her whether as he had seen my wife, and how she found her. Rather to my amaze, she said that Mary was out with the landlady when she arrived, and 8-9 o'clock came, and she was absent still. At 10 o'clock returned not my wife, but Mrs. Stokes, and with her a gentleman, who shook hands with me on coming into the room, and said, "Mr. Titmarsh, I don't know whether you will remember me. My name is Tiptoff. I have brought you a note from Mrs. Titmarsh, and a message from my wife, who sincerely commiserates your loss, and begs you will not be uneasy at Mrs. Titmarsh's absence. She has been good enough to promise to pass the night with Lady Tiptoff, and I am sure you will not object to her being away from you while she is giving happiness to a sick mother and a sick child." After a few more words, my lord left us. My wife's note only said that Mrs. Stokes would tell me all. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.